This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Brandon Contes.
Alrighty, welcome to episode 17 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Contes, and this week we have professional race car driver and NASCAR pit reporter for NBC, Parker Kligerman, joining us. Parker, thanks so much for coming on the podcast today. And I want to start by asking how you became interested in racing, because you're from Connecticut. I'm similarly from the Northeast, so I know it's not exactly a hotbed for NASCAR. Did you come from a racing family or just became interested on your own?
So funny enough, I found it on TV and I was into cars as a kid. There was a joke that I'd come out of the womb basically with a model car. I loved cars. I had all sorts of different model cars, model race cars. But when I was 9 years old, we got Speed Vision. We got Speed Vision because we got cable, which shows you how long ago this was. This was 1999. And I saw racing for the first time and I was like, wait a second, I want to do that. So many years later, we were moving towns to Westport, Connecticut, and there was a karting association in Norwalk called Norwalk Karting Association, and I convinced my parents to let me give it a go. My mom was a little more supportive than my dad. I do not come from a racing background. I am first generation. There's no one in my family from top to bottom that had ever heard of racing or NASCAR or Formula One or anything. And so it's been a journey ever since, right? To be first gen in this deal is really, really unusual. It's always been something I've been proud of, but also I know has at times been things that not just hurt me, but it's been something that I've had to, you know, break through, right? Because so many people have such long lineages in this sport, or, you know, just are very ingrained in it or have a long past or history. And I didn't. So I've been very lucky to meet some amazing people who have helped me throughout my career. And it's been a journey, as I said, but it's been very rewarding. And, you know, I think it's fun that I ended up in TV the way I did, because that's how I found this whole thing. And that's really what got me into it.
How old were you when you were doing the karting association? Because like with most sports, it's easy to get started at a young age. Like 2 year olds can kick a soccer ball or pick up a baseball and throw it. Obviously with racing, it's a little bit different to be able to find avenues of driving and racing when you are young.
Yeah. So I started the fall of 2002. So I would have been 12 years old. I sometimes say 13 because it was sort of a haphazard thing to start that fall. But yeah, so that's, you know, I've been basically doing this a little longer than 20 years now since I started, which is unbelievable. I can't even fathom that I've been doing this for two decades. it doesn't make any sense. You know, when I got into it, I loved Formula One. I wanted to go to F1 so badly. I was pretty much convinced, I think at 13 years old, that, you know, Michael Schumacher was already a bit worried that I was headed that path. And, you know, there I was going to become the next F1 world champion. And, you know, I went the open wheel route through to about 16 years old. And then, you know, my family just could not support what it took to go over to Europe and that sort of thing. I don't, you know, my dad, to his credit, although he was not the biggest fan of this journey and this path, he did support me in those early karting years and my first year in cars, but he couldn't do anything past that. And, you know, I owe him a debt of gratitude for at least giving me that chance. And I remember saying to him when we were going to cars, when I was about 15, 16, we did the Formula Renault series out in the West Coast. And I said, give me this 1 year and I'll figure out the rest. And somehow that actually came true. So it's unbelievable. You know, that the fact that I even made it out of any further than that is astonishing to me. And I tell people all the time, you couldn't replay the journey. You could do it a trillion times over and you wouldn't have the same result. It's been that unique of a path, but you know, I'm lucky to have made it all work out.
So did not coming from a racing family, like you see all the names that are involved in professional race car driving, like there's families that breed professional race car drivers. So did not coming from a racing family, did that hamper your ability as a race car driver? Are you a late bloomer because of that? Was your racing prime delayed even because you may not have been born into it the way some of these other drivers did?
No, you know, I think the big X factor for me was sim racing. You know, I was in a generation that sim racing was starting to come about. And so I was able to really hone my craft on the computer. And I know that sounds crazy, but starting in when I was 12 and I started go-karting, I was already sim racing.
Yeah.
I'd already had a wheel and pedals. I had put that together on a computer. I was obsessed with sim racing. And to me, that's the, you know, Gladwell 10,000 hour theory. I spent 10,000 hours driving virtually. And so, you know, if I wasn't going to the go-kart track or at school, I was on my computer sim racing to my own probably personal development detriment. You know, I think in eighth grade, I had, by the time I entered high school, I had zero friends because all I did was spend time on the computer racing. So, you know, that changed as I got into high school and was able to find a better balance. But yeah, definitely towards the end of middle school into high school, I was, you know, a loner who spent all their time on their computer racing cars. And to me, it made total sense. It was the thing I should be doing. It was what was going to make me better and going to make me F1 world champion. I'm sure from the outside, it looked insane. And, you know, I think it was, but it was what I needed to do because, as you point out, I didn't have any of the support of, you know, someone who knew this sport or knew how to make me a better driver or any of that, right? I needed to find a alternative path or to find an advantage, and I did by sim racing. That's why I've been such a big supporter of sim racing ever since and iRacing, because I believe it really truly is what made me a professional race car driver. It gave me opportunities, and, you know, when I look at my career, by 17 or 18, you know, I was making an ARCA start and then signed a contract with Penske. I mean, that's like signing a contract with the Yankees, right? And I had done very few races in my life by the day I signed with Penske. And the time that I sat on the pole for my first ever Xfinity start in 2009, you know, that year, Kyle Busch had done over like 55 races. I had done less than that in my entire life. So I had a quick accession, and I truly, truly believe a lot of that was centered around my, you know, spending so much time sim racing.
Yeah. So in addition to racing and broadcasting, you also own an eNASCAR team. What goes into owning an iRacing team?
So that really has morphed, you know, from being just an eNASCAR team to now we also run what we believe to be the largest independent sim racing event in America called the Firecracker 400. That's myself and Landon Castle, who's a fellow NASCAR driver. And, you know, that's an event centered around nostalgia of the late, you know, 80s era, you know, stock cars at Daytona in the summer. And that race that was just one of the more grueling races, and it's become a massive motorsports tournament that we've put together. We've done other ones. We've done a couple, you know, we've given out almost over 150,000 in prize money, which I often laugh about. I'm like, man, if we took that and put it into a business that, you know, actually had some return, we'd be geniuses. So, that's been cool. And, you know, Landon feels similar to me in terms of supporting sim racing and wanting to continue to see it to grow and, you know, knowing its importance in the motorsports hierarchy. And really what it's becoming is another form of grassroots entry to motorsports, right? And you have the eNASCAR Coca-Cola iRacing series, which is the top of that. And they become professional drivers and they make really good money, but that's still to me sort of the highest level of that level that then can give you an opportunity to go to the real world, whether that's in engineering, driving, marketing. You know, we're seeing these kids get the opportunity to get involved with real NASCAR teams or drivers like ourselves, and then parlay that into all sorts of different careers in the sport. And so I really think it's really broken the barrier of entry to entering motorsports, not just on the driving, but across the board, even announcers, right? We see young announcers like Blake McCandless, who has worked with us a bunch and does eNASCAR and is now the Cars Tour announcer. And, you know, a lot of that was because he made a friendship with Dale Earnhardt Jr. and guys like that. And myself works with me on the pit reporting side as my pit spotter. So there, when kids come up to me and they're like, how do I get involved in motorsports? I want to be an announcer. I want to do this. I always point them to sim racing. I'm like, get involved in that community, get racing, get announcing, you know, get involved with setup making, whatever it is. The iRacing and the sim racing world is the lowest barrier to entry to getting involved in motorsports. And I really think it can propel a lot of people to different careers within this sport that just weren't possible in years past.
How accurate is iRacing to the real thing?
Really close, man. I mean, tracks are incredible. You know, the physics of the race cars ebbs and flows. Racing is such a dynamic thing, right? Especially race cars, that they're constantly changing. We can barely keep up in real life with what our cars are doing. So iRacing has a massive task ahead of them of making it exactly realistic. But I would say, you know, 98% of the time, it is a very realistic representation of what we go through, no matter what car you're driving, from a Formula One car to a stock car to a Mazda MX-5 cup car. It's, my light just turned off here. Sorry.
That's right.
It's a very realistic representation across the board.
And how has iRacing grown? Like I would imagine years ago, it's something that was probably almost like mocked by real drivers. So how is it viewed now? Like does most people in the sport, do they recognize the fact that it is able to cultivate young drivers and young fans and get more people involved in the sport? Like is the value recognized more now than it used to be?
Yeah, I think the pandemic obviously was a massive catalyst for that, right? It was a lightning in a bottle moment for iRacing and sim racing and showing its ability and importance in the motorsports world. And I think from that, it's sort of you know, come back down to earth a little bit. But I do believe you look across the board from Formula One to NASCAR to IndyCar, they all have some involvement with these, you know, with sim racing. And, you know, you see, especially in the NASCAR world, I mean, look at what Keegan Leahy now works with 2311. He's an eNASCAR driver. You've got a lot of crossover like that occurring. And I think that's just going to continue to grow. And I think it's, as I said, it's not just driving. It's going to be all the different points of, you know, that of placement that happen in this sport. A lot of people are going to come from the sim racing world because it's giving them an entry at a very low barrier that, you know, going to a short track or having to physically be in places doesn't allow, you know, doesn't have that same low barrier of entry. So, you know, you look at iRacing on any given moment, there's, you know, professional drivers involved, from Max Verstappen to William Byron to myself to, you know, race teams like 2311 and, you know, RFK and that sort of thing that are involved in the sim racing community. And so because of that, I just think it's, you know, it's going to continue to, you know, maybe it doesn't grow in terms of size and amount of people that are involved. I don't know if you can ever get bigger than what happened during COVID, but it definitely continues to become integrated in the real racing world.
Can you bet on iRacing?
You know, I don't even know. We thought about that with the e-racer and everything at one point and looked into that sort of stuff. And my gosh, the regulations and such are just are mind numbing. So I don't know. I don't know if it'd be legal. I don't know.
So I grew up on Long Island, which obviously it's not far from where you grew up in Connecticut. And we have Riverhead Raceway on Long Island. First, have you ever heard of Riverhead Raceway? And second, have you ever raced there?
I have not raced there. I've heard of it. I've been near it. My girlfriend, longtime girlfriend, Shannon, is from Ronkonkoma, Long Island. So we've been up in that way. Her uncle has a business up near there. So we've actually driven right by it. But I know it's famous. I know it's a cool racetrack, but no, I have not driven it.
What is the talent drop off on a local track like that from NASCAR? Like, is it like going to the local school and the seeing who's on the basketball court there and comparing it to the NBA? Or is it not uncommon to find NASCAR like talent on those tracks?
I think it's not uncommon to find NASCAR like talent at those tracks. I think if you go to I think there's over 700 dirt tracks in the United States. There's hundreds of short tracks, obviously tons of road courses. I think if you go to any one of these specific tracks and you find a series that maybe runs there weekly, right? There's probably one person at least that is a cup level talent. that just for whatever reason, you know, lifestyle, life factors, financial factors did not move on from that, or, you know, by choice. I think sometimes you have people who, you know, don't wish to go to the highest level of this sport and the sacrifices it takes to get there. And so I truly believe this sport is unique in that you probably find one, maybe sometimes in a really great place, it's three or more that are cup level talents. And that's across the board from karting to club racing to, you know, short track racing, dirt racing. I truly believe that's the case. And that probably is worldwide, right? That's throughout every country in the world. There's one person who's a Formula One level talent. That's a NASCAR Cup Series level talent that, you know, if they wanted, if they had the chances, could have gotten there, but for every reason didn't. And that's, you know, I know that's unusual for this sport because the financial factors, right, that are involved. But I think that's also a cool thing, right? Like, yeah, because you don't make it to Cup doesn't mean this sport has to stop for whoever's in it. You know, you can go become a business person or work a normal job and race on the weekends, right, at your local short track, and, you know, do it at a very high level and show your talent and your skill and your ability and do it for a very long time. And maybe it's like golf, right? Like, maybe there's a pro at every course in the world that probably is a PGA level talent who, you know, been on to become a business person or whatever, but, you know, didn't pursue it, but right, they are that level and skill, and they choose to not go that level.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So, like, admittedly, my knowledge of the sport is minimal. I'll say that first. But how much of becoming a successful professional race car driver is dependent on talent alone? And then how much of it is dependent on also having enough financial backing and even getting paired with the right teammates?
So that's a really great question. I think it's a massive debate amongst the sport for a very long time. And I think it'll continue to be a debate for as long as the sport exists. You know, I tend to believe the cream rises to the top, and that if you're going to be in the NASCAR Cup Series or the IndyCar Series or Formula One, you've got to be top 1% at something, whether that is you're the top 1%, you know, stock car road course driver in the world, which would be an AJ Allmendinger, right? Whether you're a top 1% short track racer, a top 1% marketer, I think that's an important one, right? If you have an ability to garner sponsorship at a level that no one else can, that is a top 1% skill that can allow you to be at the highest level of this sport. You know, and I think that that means that, yes, is there a financial need and a financial barrier to entry? Of course. And there's, you know, probably the pool of people that can enter this sport and try to get to the highest level is lower because of that, right? But I don't think it's as small as people think. And I really think it's not as big a barrier for the highest talent to get to the top. If they want to get there, they have the dedication and they're willing to make the sacrifices, they'll find a way. And I think the same thing of entrepreneurship and business, right? If you are someone who is driven to succeed, to find a way, you know, the smartest person in the world doesn't always make the biggest companies or the most valuable companies, right? It's maybe often more the person who just brings the intensity and a focus and a drive to doing that, right? And I think it's the same thing for race car drivers. It's not just the most talented that make it there, but it's the combination of all those things combined. And then I do think there is, you know, there is a 1% that are just so damn good, they are going to get there no matter what they do. They're going to find themselves, but from the day they enter into a cart and they just dominate, and then they get into a car, they do the same and so on and so forth, and they just are an elite level ability at driving a race car. They will find themselves at the top of the sport because there's no other choice for them, and the sport will funnel them that way.
You're a full-time driver in the NASCAR Xfinity Series, and you're also a broadcaster on NBC. Do you think that commitment of being a broadcaster has hurt your ability to become a full-time NASCAR Cup Series driver?
Yes and no. I mean, I really didn't have a choice, right? So I when I made it to Cup in 2014 with Swan Racing, you know, my sponsorships and funding had come to a stop. I had to take the leap to being in a ride that was that I had to be a professional driver. That was the end of it. I had to take a ride. It was the only option. I had done, I thought, an amazing job in my Cup debuts in 2013. I had great stellar results across the lower series. If the Xfinity series in 2013 was what it is now with the Cup driver restrictions and such, I think I finished, and the playoff format, I think I finished second in the championship that year, with multiple wins. So, you know, I think that when Swan Racing folded, I had the opportunity to continue in some lesser funded cars, but I wasn't enthusiastic about that at the time. You know, if you look at what I was doing and the results I had, to be getting zero interest from the highest level of the sport was really a frustrating thing. And I was 23 years old. I dedicated my life to this. And, you know, there I was. I felt like performing at the highest level. I think I finished 1 point behind Kyle Larson. And yet I couldn't even get a meeting with a Cup team aside from Swan. And, you know, that was just really frustrating and really, I think at the time, a disappointing thing. I just didn't feel like I had anything that was, you know, should have been a major detriment to me getting those opportunities or those meetings. And so I, you know, chose to not take those lesser rides because I felt like, what was the point, right? No one would even call me or talk to me. That was the higher levels, you know, the more well-funded rides and that sort of thing. And so I was just sort of just disenchanted with the sport. And, you know, a couple months later, I get a call from NBC Sports asking if I'd like to do television. And I thought, okay, I'll do this. This is different, right? This is a way to flip the script. My thought was, I'll go do this. I will, you know, I guess build my notoriety, my name, because I had been told by a very prominent person that I didn't make any headlines. And therefore I felt like, okay, this is a chance to change that. And I'll go do this and I'll find myself in a top Cup ride here soon. And I did it. One thing led to another. And before I knew it, I was doing more TV than driving, obviously. And, you know, I think eventually it did open doors for me, but it wasn't at the Cup level, right? It was in trucks and it was in Xfinity, and thus became, you know, a thing where I was doing both and mixing them together. And that was a unique position to be in the sport. But, you know, the driving really kept me enthusiastic about the TV side. You know, I think I would have really struggled in my mid-20s to do the TV side if I didn't at least get to drive the amount I did. Because I, you know, that frustration with the sport and that frustration with the way I felt like I was, you know, not given many chances at the top would have, I think, you know, been a hindrance to me really, you know, being able to put my full effort behind the TV side. But thankfully I was able to find ways to race, and that kept me enthusiastic about it. And it led to this opportunity of Big Machine Racing. And, you know, it did eventually grow my notoriety and my position in the sport. And, you know, I think that became a very unique path. Now going to Cup. Yeah. I think, of course, like, I should be racing more to go to Cup. I should have been winning more races. You know, you can't run 10 races a year and expect Cup teams to call you. That's just not really a viable thing. It has happened. I mean, I have done some Cup starts. I did drive for Gaunt Brothers. I drove for Wick Ware last year for a race. Those groups called me and said, hey, we'd like you to come do this. So it did work. It just didn't work to the capacity of a full-time Cup ride. But I did get to an amazing position with Big Machine Racing and being full-time here in the Xfinity Series. And this is a cool mix. It allows me to do TV. It allows me to, you know, still race at a super high level and compete for a championship and to get to know someone as awesome as Scott Borchetta. And, you know, I think help build this Big Machine Racing team up from being a young team to hopefully being a perennial championship contender. And so, you know, it's basically everything you could have hoped for. It's just not Cup. It's Xfinity. So I think it's a really cool position to be. I'm still young. I'm just turned 33. I feel like, you know, if it all comes to stop next year, I've got plenty more careers and things I can then jump into right now, because I really feel like I'm basically in the first third of life, and maybe even the first quarter. I don't know. You know, like, I think we're all going to live to be like 120 at this point. So I got a long time to go. I can, you know, keep chasing trophies here and checkered flags for as long as they'll let me. And then, you know, that if that if that's sooner than later that stops or whatever, you know, I now know I have other skills and other knowledge that I can apply out in other facets of the world. But it's, you know, I will say this, no matter what happens, I am very grateful to still be involved in motorsports level I am. And I know that I will continue to be involved in this sport for as long as I'm, you know, on this earth, because to me, it's my passion. I love it. I love the support. I love to see it grow. I love to be a help in helping it grow. And so, you know, I will find a way to be a part of this in some capacity. And you know, I'm very thankful to TV for sure showing me that I could be involved for a very long time.
Would you leave NBC for the opportunity to drive full time in Cup? Like, is that something you're still aspiring to do?
You know, I've been asked this question a lot lately, and I don't know. I've really tried to not think about Cup. Like, I've just tried to focus on big machine racing and the Xfinity Series and winning at this level. And really, I just want to win, and I want to contend for a championship. And then whatever happens is a bonus, right? Like, if I am offered the opportunity to go to Cup, you know, in a great situation, awesome. If I'm not, I'm not upset about that. Like, that, you know, I'm past the point of saying, you know, I've got to be the 19-time Cup Series champion. I just don't, you know, I want to win. I want to be the best damn race car driver I can possibly be at this time. And I've put a huge amount of effort and resources and sacrifice behind that this year and for a while now. And, you know, to me, this is the payoff. This is the payoff to get to be a part of big machine racing and to work with Scott Borchetta and to help him grow this race team and to work with Big Machine Vodka Spike Light Coors and, you know, to experience this at such a high level and to go win. Like, that's on my mind. You know, Cup, obviously I sit there and I think like, wow, that'd be so cool. And I'd love that opportunity. But then, you know, I feel like everyone has a different, I guess not path, but you know, we all have different unique skill sets and maybe, you know, being, I don't know, I don't like to say it this way, but you know, maybe you're top 30 in the world at something, but if you're the top of top in something else, maybe that's a smarter, you know, direction. So, I don't know. I try not to think about it. I think, I'm very lucky to be in the position to race on Saturdays and broadcast the highest level of sport on Sundays. And what a cool mix. And, you know, at this time, I just want to win and do the best job I can for NBC on the broadcast side and cover the, you know, the Cup Series the best way and bring, you know, something unique each week from being a driver in the midst of fighting on, you know, to be in my own playoff battle and the fight for a championship to win races. And, you know, hopefully brings that little bit that that no one else could. And, you know, if that adds something really great to the broadcast or for fans out there or makes them a bigger fan of it, then, you know, that's really gratifying to me.
With the notoriety that you have now built in the sport as a broadcaster over the years, do you think that more high level Cup teams should be knocking on your door?
I think I need to win more races. You know, I've done a good job this year. I like to say I probably had I'm a B plus this year, A minus maybe. You know, there's things I could have done better for sure. And then there's areas where I feel like, man, I've really extracted a lot from this race, you know, and help build this race team and make it a better race team over the last 8 months. And you know, that part I feel very proud of. Do I believe that, you know, I'm a playoff capable Cup Series driver? Absolutely. I mean, I've raced most of those guys. I've run up front or beat a lot of them. You know, I absolutely believe that. I've believed that this entire time. But if I don't, you know, you also have to have the mix, right? You got to have the mix of the opportunity, the team, the funding, everything all to come together to compete at the Cup Series level. And if I'm given that opportunity, awesome. If not, as I said, I know that I deep down, you know, if I can win at this level and win often, then I know I'm that level, right? And you got to beat people that are going to go on to be playoff contenders in the Cup Series. You got to beat Justin Allgaier, who's, you know, no doubt a Cup level talent that has made a home in the Xfinity Series, right? You know, you're going to have to beat drivers who are undoubtedly going to be in the Cup Series. So it's winning at this level proves a lot to me.
Was there any resentment? I would say even more earlier when you started broadcasting, because you experienced those frustrations of not getting calls and opportunities from Cup teams, and there were drivers that you had beaten in races that were making it to the Cup Series. So here you are now, kind of becoming a broadcaster and you're covering some of those drivers that you've beaten. Was there resentment earlier on towards those drivers?
Not resentment towards them. No, you know, I think I said this the other day in a piece with NBC where, you know, the part that was tough was standing there on pit road or interviewing a person, you know, who you had beaten, who's going on to win races, and you'd stand there and you'd look at it and, you know, have that moment of introspection and be like, why am I not doing that? Right. And I think I never chose the path of blaming others. I never chose the path of feeling resentment towards my competitors or, you know, even the decision makers in the sport. Right. To me, I always looked inward and have always looked inward or looked in the mirror and said, okay, what did you do? What can you do better to have changed this situation? Right. And I really think that's been my secret sauce to continuing to develop opportunities and to continue to, you know, get the chance to drive. And I think it was only human, right, that I had times where I'm like, man, what am I doing? Like, why? Why am I here and they're there and I want to be doing that, but I can't seem to figure out how to get there. And yeah, that is frustrating. It's been a wild decade basically that I think I always felt like, oh, I'd figure it out or I'd come up with a master plan. And it just, you know, but I kept having to just do the things that were in front of me, right? Which was go broadcast at the best level I could and take that opportunity and to race the races I got offered, right? And sure, I had other business ventures in there. I've had other media ventures in there. You know, I've hosted a TV show for 3 seasons, the Proving Grounds. You know, I did other things, which actually, when I look back right now, I will say, you know, I talk about that where, you know, I was maybe frustrated with the sport and not getting this Cup opportunities, but man, have I had a very dynamic decade that, yeah. You know, you people say, I heard a great quote the other day on one of my favorite podcasts is How I Built This. And I think it was the founder of Kinko's who said his mom told him, try everything you can in your 20s, figure out what you're good at in your 30s, make a lot of money in your 40s and don't do any, you know, try to do as little as possible in your 50s. I definitely tried a lot of things in my 20s. I had a startup, multiple startups. I did broadcasting. I've raced and I've all, you know, made it all the way back to being a full-time race car driver. So that's pretty cool. And I still don't know if I figured out what I'm good at. So, you know, I'm only in 3 years into the 30s, right? So I probably got a couple years to figure it out. But that's, if I think about it from a positive mindset, the idea that I've gotten to do all those things and still get to be involved in the sport I love and get to drive at a high level with a great race team for an awesome owner is, I mean, that's a cool thing. And I think it's made, you know, I love biographies and I love the idea of people who have maybe made an uncharted path, right? A path that has never been seen before, never done. And I really believe that my path is probably never been done before. And that's a really, really amazing feeling. And, you know, at times it can be, I don't know, I don't want to say disappointing, but it can be frustrating because you're like, well, there's no template for this. How does one find themselves out of this situation or you know, parlay it, because there's no one that's done this before. But I think that's also a cool thing. And it's really prepared me, you know, for all stages of life. And so did I dream in my early years that I was going to be the greatest race car driver of all time and have all the trophies and whatever? For sure. But you know, life doesn't go to plan. It's what you make of it. And I definitely in my quieter moments can sit back and look at all the stuff I've done and be like, whoa, this is crazy. How did you fit all that in just 33 years? I don't know. But it makes me really excited, for whatever comes next.
I think there's definitely benefits to getting started on a broadcasting career earlier in life rather than waiting until you know, you were a retired driver.
Well, it did it all backwards. Someone said that to me the other day. They're like, you know, what's funny about you is you got the broadcasting portion out of the way in your 20s. And I was like, well, yeah, no, I've just done it all backwards. You're supposed to win all the championships and get all the trophies and then go into broadcasting.
Is it strange that broadcasting is the more secure job in NASCAR than being a driver?
I don't know. No, because you know, I think there are. And I don't want to say this like in a way of patting myself on the back or anything. I do believe there's less people in the world who can broadcast, you know, a sport or speak into a camera to millions of people in a way that the broadcast wants, the sport wants, then there are people that possibly can drive race cars, right? And so I think that makes it a smaller pool, right? That makes it and people that want to do it, right? Like that's the other thing that maybe want to do. I think there's a lot more people that want to be race car drivers, right? So I think that makes it sort of it's just a different vocation, right? Than driving race cars. And it's hard to compare the two. I think it's the same, like, you know, in the NFL, like you probably have more people that want to be quarterbacks than, you know, sideline reporters, I would think. But that's natural. They're the show, right? The broadcasters we're not the show. You know, we are trying to cover and explain and, you know, show this sport at its best. And, you know, sometimes explain, you know, what's happening when it's not at its best, right? Or what's going on. And so it's just a different vocation than being a part of the show and driving.
Yeah, and if there's less people that are capable or willing to be a high-level broadcaster than a race car driver, I think there's even less of a pool that are willing to do both at the same time. And
yeah, or stupid enough to try and mix the two, right?
And it is interesting because, like, obviously, you mentioned that there's not really a blueprint for what you're doing. There's a long list of pro athletes who have become broadcasters, but there's not many athletes who have done both at the same time. Like Charles Barkley and Tony Romo, they waited until they retired before they started their broadcasting career full time. Does what you're doing, does it feel, you know, racing in the Xfinity series and reporting in the Cup series, does it feel unique or even groundbreaking?
Yeah, I think in our sport, mixing the two like I am now, I look at like what Kenny Wallace was doing, a lot of TV back when he was racing full time the Busch Series. He was doing Speed Channel stuff. Obviously, you had Kyle Petty who mixed it a little bit. You know, I don't think that part is specifically unique. I think my, you know, path through these and the mix I had maybe my late 20s was a bit more unique, right? But I think we see this in racing because, you know, to that point, there's just not a lot of people, one, who have experienced driving this high level, right? So they can explain it. And then, you know, for them to have driven at this high level, been successful, and then also willing to step in front of a camera in front of millions of people or a live audience and fluently describe that or explain it or make it entertaining, right? That's a unique skill set. You know, there's not a lot of Dale Jr.'s out there. Like he's incredible. Steve LaTarte's incredible. You know, Jeff Burton, you know, these are former competitors of this sport that are also just incredible at being able to explain and entertain and, you know, make it an interesting thing. So there's just probably not a lot of them out there, right? That makes that part really different. And so, you know, I think that's why you maybe have seen Kenny Wallace, right, before myself, you know, in terms of being a pit reporter and doing the things I'm doing. And actually, you know, go back even further. Let's look at, like, Jackie Stewart when he got into broadcasting. And who else was out there at that time? I saw Neil Bonnett did some broadcasting. Heck, Jimmy Johnson, I think, did some pit reporting when he was in the off-road racing ranks. So race car drivers are great marketers, right? As well, usually, because they gotta be. And there's no better marketing than standing in front of a camera and talking about the thing you love. And so I think that part's not unique, but definitely the path and the way I've put the two together has definitely been unique.
Who are some current drivers that you think could have a future in broadcasting if they wanted it?
Oh, well, Denny Hamlin. I mean, his podcast is great. He shows that ability. I think, you know, no doubt in my mind, he'll do whatever he wants to do in that sense. Who else is out there that's really interesting? Man, I think Bubba Wallace would be great, you know, if he wanted to be in this deal. I think he'd be awesome. He's so open, you know, especially I have such respect for how open he is about the mental side of the sport. As that becomes a trend, I think, you know, within the world, within sports, you know, I've really dived deep in the mental side and been open about that since I came in back full time. But I think there's few sports that are as mental a game as driving a race car or golf. Right. And so I just think he has such a unique point of view. And I look at him as like a Dale Jr. who's had an immense amount of eyes on him and, you know, immense amount of people that are paying attention to every minute move he makes. And I think that makes you so well prepared to go into the broadcasting realm and to take it seriously and to offer a unique perspective. So I think he'd be great. Corey LaJoy, I think he'd be great. Of course, he's a funny guy. You know, he'd be entertaining, no doubt in my mind. So I think you have numerous drivers in the sport who will, you know, when that time comes or if they want to, will have that opportunity.
Do you think drivers are more comfortable speaking to you than a reporter who wasn't a professional race car driver or isn't a professional race car driver? Like, are they more candid with you because you're a driver too?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I get some of the comments sometimes like, yeah, you should be driving this thing or that sort of thing. And I think that's kind of fun. But, you know, the other side of it is sometimes I ask a question and I know they look at me like, why are you asking this? You know that answer. And it's like, I have to explain, hey, man, I'm not asking for me. I'm asking for the people, you know, behind this camera that don't know. Right. Like, I know the answer, but it's not as impactful for me to say, put words in your mouth or answer it for you. Like, right. They want to hear from you. So that's always been something that I feel like has been a consistent theme for me. I did see on Reddit the other day, some fans thought that they actually are more annoyed by me, which I was like, man, I don't get that feeling at all. So I think TV is so subjective, right? At the end of the day, it's humans talking to other humans. So how that gets in the there is very few facts in there about how you're going to interpret, you know, their the way they go about it, the responses, that sort of thing. It's entirely subjective. So I think for every person who loves the way you ask a question or talk to the camera or present a piece or your vocabulary, there's another person that absolutely hates it, right? And that's just – I think that is just basically a guarantee in this game. And I think for anyone who's in any level of broadcasting or podcasting or ever can sense that, has felt that at some point. And so, you know, I take all feedback with a grain of salt. And really my guiding light for all my TV and people ask about asking questions, that sort of stuff. And I've always said my guiding light is this. I simply think, what did 9-year-old Parker watching Speed Vision want to know? And if I feel like it's something I wanted to know, then it's probably the right path. And it's just that simple for me. And because I was an absolutely obsessed person with motorsports at 9 years old, that there was possibly nothing over the next, you know, 10 years that I didn't consume in terms of content on the internet, on Speed Vision, Speed Channel, and, you know, in magazine and book form. So if that kid can feel like, oh man, that's cool, I'm glad they asked that, or whatever, then I feel like I'm doing my job.
So while you're asking the questions that, like, you might know the answers, or you probably do know the answers to, but as a reporter, do you ever get inside information from other drivers or anything that you've been then able to take to the track and use yourself?
Yeah, I think all reporters, you know, have that a little bit, right? Where, you know, you have your information that's clearly on the record. There's stuff that's off the record, and you might, you know, want to be like, hey, do you mind if I talk about this? Or can we, you know, would you mind talking about that? Right. And I think that's normal human interaction, no matter what you're doing, in any sort of highly visible, you know, situation. So, no, I don't think there's, you know, there's not times where I've like, you know, tried to get some information and then make it public or that sort of thing. You know, I don't think that's not my role. That's not fair. Right. I do believe, you know, you can be respectful and you can respect people's privacy while also, you know, helping the fans truly understand what's going on for that competitor at that time. And that's something I've always tried to do.
Has being a reporter and needing to ask difficult questions ever hurt a friendship that you had on the racetrack?
No, I mean, I've definitely had drivers angry. But you know, I never feel like they're angry. Like personally, I don't think they're angry at me, right? Yeah. It's the situation, it's the circumstance, that sort of thing. And of course they're angry, but you know, especially if they say something that's maybe derogatory or whatever, I don't take it personally because I've been in their position and I know how, you know, the what's going through their mind after they've made a mistake and wrecked, right? And it may be a high pressure situation made that mistake. And it's a really, you're more frustrated with yourself, right? And I, so therefore I always tell people I'm just there as a vehicle to hold the mic and to let you say what you will. And if it's directed at me, so be it. I'm not taking it personally. Like that's part of the job. I'm not going to take any of that personally. You know, you can say whatever you want, but at the end of the day, I'm there doing my job of holding, you know, presenting the mic and presenting an outlet for you to talk to the fans, the millions of people around the world who want to know those answers and know what's going through your mind. And if you need to use me as a, you know, as a punching bag, so be it. That's no problem.
What about from fans? Has your reporting or analysis ever drawn backlash from them?
What did I say before? It's subjective. For everyone that loves what you do, there's going to be one that hates it. So yes, of course I've seen, you know, negative stuff and I usually just sort of laugh. I personally go by the Jay-Z theory of like, you know, at least they're talking about you. So when I, or the Dale Earnhardt, you know, 50% are cheering, 50% booing, you just want to make a noise, right? To me in this game, if they're not talking about you, then you probably aren't doing something right. And that's, you know, that's hopefully in the good side, but, and that should be everyone's intention. But I do believe that, you know, you in this era of the level and amount of content out there, you know, you don't need to be clickbait, but you should be a person that's well-respected, that has, you know, that has opinions that you stand by and strong convictions, but be willing to obviously to have the open mind to be able to change those opinions and convictions with new information or facts. And if you follow that template, and are respectful, I think, you know, there's a lot of room out there to have a lot of conversation and to be someone who, you know, propels the sports forward or that, you know, or brings the correct information, but does it in a way that, you know, doesn't always bring that ear. But of course you're going to rub someone the wrong way somewhere in the path of being on, in the content sphere. I mean, look, this podcast, today I'm doing this one. I'll do our podcast, The Money Lap, which will be an hour and a half. I'll do a VO for the eNASCAR series here, highlights. We're going to have probably 25 clips from that hour long podcast. We'll probably clip this podcast. I've been on the broadcast this weekend and raced. So I think, you know, in there's probably 24 plus hours of content and video and time that I'll be on a screen or being recorded. Somewhere in there, I'll probably annoy someone. So that's just probably math.
How do you balance that schedule, like with racing? How do you prepare for broadcasting, do all these podcasts, and prepare for racing in the same week? What does that schedule look like?
I don't know, terribly. I probably would love some advice. you know, so what I say to people is I don't play golf. Like, I don't have hobbies. I am a race car driver, a broadcaster, and then, you know, the Money Lap is a small media company. We have a newsletter. We have a podcast, the clips. We have employees, people that work for us, contractors, sorry. And, you know, that is a small startup operation that is, you know, would replace the time I think people would go play golf, right? And for me, that's just, I like being in motorsports and I like building brands and being a part of an entity getting, you know, gaining momentum and building something that people want, right? And I love learning about that side of the world. And I love, you know, being involved with helping our sponsorship partners get more from their part, you know, their partnerships with us. And I love, you know, seeing, finding young talent out there in, you know, different spheres, you know, for our video team and our podcast producers and, you know, our newsletter team and just seeing like them grow and become better at that and learn. And I'm learning at the same time. So I love that. And so, you know, in terms of balancing it, it's not that hard. Like I, you know, everything has a priority. The racing comes first. So that's first and foremost, broadcasting right there beside it. But the two mix really easily together. And I'd say better than ever, to be honest. And then, you know, the podcast stuff and Money Lap, get, you know, sort of fill in the gaps of where maybe you'd go play golf. And then I have my personal life and, you know, it's a mix for sure, but, and I won't do this forever, right? I don't know if I'd have this level of a schedule forever. Right. But it's something that I enjoy. So it's not work, right? They say like, you'll never work a day in your life if you enjoy it. And that's truly to me, like, especially the media, you know, the Money Lap stuff, I think a lot of people would view as work and as, you know, a job. And I don't, like, I love that. I love the idea of building a brand and working with people and trying to grow something. And so to me, it's just too much fun.
NASCAR is the only sport where men and women can compete at the same level on the same field at the same time, which is unique. And I think it's a really cool thing that it can offer. Does NASCAR try to increase the representation of women? Is women's participation growing in the sport?
I hope so. You know, I think that's one of the coolest things about motorsports is that it can be, you know, a multi-gender sport and they can compete on a level playing field, right? And I think that's so cool and so unique and offers so much opportunity. I'd love to see a woman win the Daytona 500, a woman win a Formula One race. Like I think we will. I think the growth of motorsports over the last couple of years, and obviously in America, it's had a re-energy, you know, with the Drive Survive deal with Formula One and their growth and what that's done for the other motorsports. I think they've seen growth and you've got NASCAR doing things like Chicago, that sort of thing. That's going to attract new eyeballs and new people. And hopefully within there are young women who want to become race car drivers and will get the support and the, you know, the financial backing and the opportunities in high level equipment to go out there and prove that they can compete at this level as well. And I know we've seen many women come through IndyCar and NASCAR and, you know, not so much in Formula One. And I think that's going to increase. And I think that when the numbers increase to me, that offers up the opportunity. It goes back to that same thing we talked about with broadcasting. If the pool is small, right? You know, you want that pool to be as big as possible to find the best talent out there. And so I would love to see that. And I think it should absolutely be something that NASCAR is pushing for, that IndyCar is pushing for, that Formula One is pushing for. You know, we're going before I die. I truly believe I will see a woman win the Daytona 500, the Indy 500 and a Formula One race.
The NASCAR Cup playoff series are set. The first four races air on USA. The final six are going to be on NBC. Looking at that field of 16, do you have a championship four or championship prediction?
So I'm actually supposed to make that this morning for Money Lap. We're doing that. I haven't fully fleshed it out. I'm sorry, but I will say, and I say this every year, it's Denny Hamlin's year until it isn't. So he's my champ until he's not. I think I've done this for 4 or 5 years in a row. I just think the guy is so good that if he could just get to Phoenix with the right set of circumstances, he, you know, and Chris Gabehart is such an incredible crew chief. That 11 team is so good. You know, a championship has to be at the other end of that, somewhere in there. And so, yeah, I truly believe it's Denny Hamlin's year until it isn't.
You mentioned Bubba Wallace earlier while we were talking. Was it good to see him clinch his first playoff spot?
Yeah, that was cool. I mean, what a pressure-packed situation, right? I'm like, my God. I approached our race at Daytona thinking it was a cutoff race like he was. And I did that for multiple reasons, but one of the largest reasons was to I mentally locked in. And because I looked back at the Super Speedway races that I had won, and one consistent theme that I had discovered in my mindset and what I was doing in the last portion of the race was that I was so locked in, it was almost at the subconscious level of making decisions and driving and that sort of thing. And so I was like going into this Daytona race with the pressure we were under with the, you know, the playoff situation and the points needed. I said to myself, what if you could lock in from lap one like that to lap 100? What would happen? And so I worked really hard all week on, you know, mentally getting myself to turn that switch on. And that meant before the race, you know, I sort of put my phone away. I didn't speak to anyone at intros. You know, I saw Bubba Wallace didn't give us an interview before the race. And I actually respected that because I was like, man, you know, I did one, but that was the only thing I did within the hour of the race on Friday night. Otherwise, I sat alone and I played moves in my head and kept my brain think, you know, locked in with the thought of I'm driving a race car at a Super Speedway making moves. And what do I need to do to be up front? And that's how I approached that race. And I feel like I was successful because of that. And when I look at what he accomplished on Saturday, to me, that was a driver that was locked in, that knew what was at stake, that knew what he had to do, and found a way to stay in that mental state the entire race and was able to, you know, be rewarded for it. And so I think it was a really impressive drive in, you know, the midst of the chaos that is Super Speedway racing. And, you know, comparing the Xfinity Series to the Cup Series isn't exactly fair. It's a far deeper pool in the Cup Series. So what he did was far more impressive than what I did. But yeah, I think it was definitely, you know, a testament to his ability at those tracks and probably an amazing relief afterwards to have made it in.
Yeah, I know there was some like controversy surrounding his Bubba Wallace's decision to forego interviews before and after the race. Do you think, is that something that like, does he owe it to the fans, owe it to the sport to speak before and after a race? Or is it more that he already does a lot to promote the sport? It's not like he stays silent throughout the entire season, that just, you know, before and after the race, you kind of say, okay, that's fine to skip those interviews.
I think as long as it's not a trend, right? Like, I think there's moments for sure. Absolutely. They have that right. Every competitor does, especially before an event. You know, I think afterwards that you more so owe it to the fans to explain what happened, right? Post-event, to me, is far more important. Pre-event, I don't find it, you know, I think if he needs that half hour to lock in, like I described, then by all means. Now, if you do that 38 weeks out of 38 weeks, that's probably not fair to fans. But, you know, if you pick and choose your spots on a high pressure situation he was entering on that night, I had no problem with it. I felt like, why not? You know, that I have respect for the competitors and whatever they need to do to feel like they're in the best position to go out and perform. And everyone's different. And, you know, for him, he needed that, and that's fine. And then, you know, after the race to talk to the media, it's fine. That's great. He told us, you know, hey, look, this is what happened. This is what I went through. And, you know, this is how I did it. And I think that part is far more important than what you say beforehand, and giving them that entrance, you know, that little bit before, because, you know, all these sports are about your physical ability and your mental ability. Right. And like, that is, you know, unless you're a professional athlete, you or have been one, you seldom know what it's like to know that your everything comes down to specific tiny moments that depend that you have put your body in the best position possible and your mind. And that is the special, you know, the secret sauce in sports. That is the special X factor in great athletes. And it's something that I think, you know, should be respected and should be applauded for however they get there, as long as it's, you know, a positive thing.
Is it cool to see Michael Jordan involved in the sport?
Heck yeah, that's awesome. I stood there in pit lane and be like, that's Michael Jordan. What is happening here? I almost interviewed him, I think 2 years ago or a year ago, and they end up not wanting to do an interview, but that was fine. It was during qualifying, I think at Nashville or something. But I don't know, like, very seldom do I get nervous. But on that moment, I was pretty nervous. I was like, if I'm going to interview Michael Jordan, like, this is by far the most nerve-wracking thing I've ever done. So that is so cool. And yeah, he seems, I just love his passion, how excited, you know, for him to be there that night. And even like when he shows up to Nashville for qualifying, like, this guy loves this stuff. And that is so cool because, you know, he is and will ever be, forever will be, one of the greatest athletes of all time. And one of, you know, I think at his peak was the most known athlete in the world. Like, that is, I mean, gosh, talk about just accomplishment and all that he's done. His business world, I have huge respect for. You know, just such a cool guy that is so awesome to see be involved in motorsports.
Parker, thanks so much for coming on the podcast today. I really appreciate it. You were excellent.
Thank you, bud. Appreciate it. Yeah, this has been fun. I think the motorsports world has a bright future. I hope to be a part of it, you know, for a long time to come, as I said. And you know, I will put something out there on this because I think the people that listen to this have respect and would understand this. You know, I think the one thing our sport is missing, and, you know, I don't know when and where it will come and how it will come about. And maybe it never does. Maybe it's a new form these days, but I do wonder about a true motorsports show in America in some capacity that has a large distribution, a large audience, and where that will come from. And I'd be interested to hear from fans out there how that'll happen and how they would foresee or where that would be and what it would look like, because I do think this sport is so vast and so there's so much going on all the time. You know, that's something that should happen here soon.
Yeah. We'll pitch it to ESPN for you.
There you go. Thank you. Appreciate it.
That is Parker Kligerman. I'm Brandon Contis. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Please rate and subscribe to this podcast. Please also subscribe to Awful Announcing's YouTube page. But regardless of how you consume Awful Announcing and Awful Announcing's podcast, thanks for listening and be good.
Thanks for listening to the Awful Announcing Podcast. For the latest news spanning the sports media landscape and more, check out awfulannouncing.com and follow us at awfulannouncing.com.